too much. Jane insisted over and over that he had to find someone to take the burden off of him. He invited Ovitz over for a long lunch, where he again raised the possibility of Ovitz being his partner. This time, he was more concrete. He said he'd give Ovitz the title of co-chairman, which sounded good to Ovitz, who said he'd think about it. Eisner insisted that he never offered Ovitz the title of co-chairman. Ovitz thought Eisner seemed depressed. He looked terrible, and not just because of the physical effects of the surgery. Ovitz didn't know how seriously to take Eisner's offer, because he had made some other suggestions that struck Ovitz as bizarre. Among them, he said he wanted his wife Jane to be on the Disney board. "That's ludicrous," Ovitz replied. And he said he wanted to position his son Breck to succeed him as chairman. "Michael, this isn't your family company," Ovitz said. Eisner called Ovitz the next day, saying he'd had second thoughts, and making Ovitz co-chairman wasn't a good idea. It would never work in corporate America, he said. After that, Eisner dropped the subject of bringing Ovitz to Disney. Instead, he spoke again to George Mitchell, put a feeler out to Bob Daley at Warner Brothers, and made an appointment to see Roger Enrico, chairman of PepsiCo. Feeling he couldn't take any more pressure, Eisner finally called and asked Katzenberg to meet him at his house on Sunday, August 7th. They sat in the den, Eisner still in his bathrobe. Eisner began complaining about the press, about how stressful it was for him, especially reports that Katzenberg was threatening to quit. Katzenberg interrupted him and adopted a different tone. "I never told Frank Wells how much I liked working with him and how much I loved him," the normally unemotional Katzenberg said. "I realize I've never told you how much you've meant to me." Eisner seemed taken aback by the sudden shift. Katzenberg continued, thanking Eisner for the experience of working together. It had the feeling of a valedictory. "Now I guess it's time for me to move on." Confronted with the prospect of the very thing he seems most to have wanted, Katzenberg's departure, Eisner tried to change Katzenberg's mind. "Have you taken another job?" Eisner asked. "No, not yet." "Is it something we can discuss?" Katzenberg said he'd come to realize that Roy and Stanley Gold were implacably opposed to him, even if Eisner could be persuaded to promote him. "I can fix it," Eisner insisted, according to Katzenberg. He even volunteered to speak to Gold and the rest of the board on Katzenberg's behalf. In the meantime, he asked Katzenberg to pull together his thoughts on reorganizing the company. Katzenberg wasn't optimistic and felt confused. Reorganizing the company seemed like a presidential-level task. Had his decision to leave finally brought Eisner around to his view? He didn't know, but he started work on a memo. For someone who was ostensibly trying to make it work, Eisner soon sabotaged the effort. A few days later, on Wednesday, Eisner called Katzenberg to discuss Pocahontas, specifically whether he'd dealt with the issues Eisner had raised before his surgery. "They're insignificant," Katzenberg replied, which angered Eisner and gave him the distinct impression that they'd been ignored. Katzenberg argued that given his past success in animation, Eisner should trust his instincts. "Jeffrey," Eisner retorted,